Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Gravity Leadership is a community of people seeking to live our lives in the orienting center of God's love in the midst of our post-Christian world, learning to lead like Jesus, live on mission, and make disciples. In nature, gravity is the phenomenon that brings stuff together, objects as small as atoms and quarks and as large as stars and galaxies. We believe the gravity of the Christian life is the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ. The Gravity Leadership Podcast is curated conversations on what it looks like to practically orient our lives and our leadership in the love of Christ, the gravity that holds everything together.
Hey friends, this is Ben. Welcome to another episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. I'm here with my friend Matt.
I'm here.
And today on the podcast, we are going to have a conversation with Austin Fisher. Austin is the lead pastor at Vista Community Church in Temple, Texas, and he is the author of a new book called Faith in the Shadows, Finding Christ in the Midst of Doubt. It's good to have you, Austin.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. I've enjoyed what you're doing from a distance, and so it's nice to kind of jump in.
Awesome. Good.
Can I ask the first question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Where is Temple, Texas?
Yeah.
Well, the thriving metropolis of Temple, Texas is located approximately halfway in between Austin and Waco in Central Texas.
Austin and Waco, man, Central Texas.
Yep.
That's kind of, how many people is in Temple or in Temple?
So Temple, Belt, and Killeen, they're three cities kind of all together. And all of them together is about 300, probably 1,000.
Okay. It's kind of a little metropolitan area there.
Not exactly rural.
That's rural? That's my top 10. Rural.
Rural.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. So we wanted to have a conversation about some of the stuff you wrote about in your book, Austin, because it intersects quite a bit with our work. We've talked a previous episode about finding God in our doubts and in our dark places. And your book is kind of about that. Your book is about where we find God in the midst of those doubts that we may have. But I'm curious about why you wrote this book. I'm curious about what it was about your experience of doubt that made you realize that this book needed to be written, or maybe that, you know, you realize, man, I need this book for my own experiences.
Yeah, that's a huge part of it. When you write a book, it's typically such a labor to write that you usually only do it if you feel like it's something you have to do. And so when I kind of went through a pretty difficult journey with doubt, where I really didn't know if I could believe in God anymore at a certain point, just realized that I, as a pastor, have all these tools and training to be able to process stuff like this, or so you would think. And yet I really, really struggled. And again, I didn't really know where to turn when I was in the midst of it. And so when I kind of got through it, just thought that, man, there are a lot of people who don't have a lot of the resources and training that I've been given as a quote unquote professional to deal with this. And so it would be really, really helpful for average folks to have something like this to be able to use as a kind of, you know, it's not a guidebook, but it's more of a, oh, here's someone who dealt with doubt, who almost walked away from their faith because of it, and yet still found a way to believe at the end of things because of it. And so that's what the book was meant to be, a guidebook for how to doubt faithfully.
Yeah. And what struck me about that is, I think there's two dominant imaginations we have in sort of contemporary Christianity about what to do with doubt. One is we fight it, right? We get our evidence that demands a verdict, and we just machine gun all our doubts.
Someone should call a book that or something.
Well, yeah, you should.
That'll be a whole series of products, maybe.
or we kind of escape our doubt, right? So we kind of use Sunday worship as an opiate to numb the gnawing doubt or the aching darkness we're feeling. But you have a different way of dealing with doubt in this book that I think is really helpful. I mean, you do give some information, you reframe the way we should approach or posture doubt. Can you talk about how you discovered that and what that looks like?
Yeah, I think you've laid out the two typical options pretty clearly. And one of them is, you know, when you've got doubts, you just shove them down deep in the basement of your heart, hoping that they'll suffocate from the inattention, you know, and just magically go away. Yeah. And again, in my experience, the people who walk away from their faith aren't the people who had doubts. It was the people who had doubts and were afraid to be honest about them until it was too late.
Yeah.
And so that's what I, you know, try to help people understand is if you try to ignore your doubts just grow stronger, and they know that you're not playing honest. They know that you're not playing fair. And so they just grow more monstrous when you hide from them. The second option is this sort of, it's usually when we think of rationalism, you think of like, you know, a scientifically minded atheist or something like that. But I have encountered super conservative fundamentalists, probably even more than conservative Christians, who are every bit the rationalists.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Who think that if we just approach, you know, scripture and the historical evidence with an open mind, then you'd have to be a complete idiot to not be a Christian.
Right.
And that's just not the case, you know, anyway, so rationalists come on kind of both sides of the equation there. And so the kind of route that I walked was really one that I think you find typified most in the book of Job, right? And most people are familiar with Job, but they're not as familiar as they think they are with it, right? So Job loses everything in chapters 1 and 2. He says all the right things, ends chapter 2 in this spot of like humble piety. The Lord gave, the Lord's taken away, blessed be the name of the Lord. And most people stop reading Job there. Right. And the next 36, 38 chapters are Job just losing his mind and letting God have it, verbally assaulting God, really. I mean, bordering on heresy at multiple different places. At the end, God shows up in the whirlwind. Obviously, he puts Job in his place. Where were you when I created the stars? Do you know where the mountain goats give birth? You know, all that. But the book ends in chapter 42.
Austin, do you know where the mountain goats give birth?
I do not. Okay. I would assume on the mountains, but
I always felt like that was an easy.
Is this a trick question, God?
Yeah. The mountain. Keep going, God. Your overall point's good, but I got you there.
Yeah, you had me on the stars, but mountain goats. Yeah. That's the difficult. Anyways, in chapter 42, you know, God says, "Job, you, the guy who verbally assaulted me for like 36 chapters, you spoke rightly of me, but your friends, the three friends who told you to praise God, don't doubt, get over it, they spoke wrongly of me." And my wrath is kindled against them. And in fact, Job, I'm going to need you to offer sacrifices for them so I don't smoke them and give them what they deserve. So, in, you know, how in the world has Job, who said all these terrible things about God, some of which God has kind of, you know, repudiated, spoken rightly of God?
Yeah.
And I think the best explanation we can come up with is that Job spoke rightly in the sense that he had the courage to speak honestly, even when he didn't have anything nice to say. And so Job is this kind of paradigm for what it looks like to deal with our doubt faithfully. Job kept the conversation going with God, even when he didn't have anything nice to say. And yes, he got put in his place, but he also encountered the living God in a whirlwind.
Right.
Yeah, so it sounds like then the impression I'm getting, even for Job and perhaps for us on this podcast and the people listening, is that doubt can be a tutor that disabuses us of a certitude that masquerades for faith.
Yeah.
Right?
I think that's a great way to say it. Yeah, doubt properly handled can push us toward God instead of away from God, and that's always been the case.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the contrast there that's fascinating to me is you've said this phrase a couple times, faithfully experiencing our doubt. And I think the reason people are so afraid of experiencing doubt is because they like that word faithfully and doubt feel like opposites to them, right?
Yeah.
Because we have, like you said, Matt, because we have equated our faith with certainty. So we know we're being faithful if we're certain about things. Mm-hmm. And any like niggling doubts are evidence that we're not faithful. And so we can't verbalize those things. It's almost like a slippery slope kind of argument.
Sure. When you think of your faith as something that you have to be certain in with mathematical certainty, you know,
right.
Or else it doesn't count as faith, then there's only one thing to do with your doubts, and that's to push them away and not think about them, because any sort of exploring your doubts is probably going to mean you're not as certain, certainly not while you're processing them. And so that's where I think a lot of us have been set up to fail. That's where I was set up to fail is when you think that you have to be certain in order to have real vibrant faith, then sooner or later, you figure out you can't be certain. And so you have to ask yourself if you can still have faith. And a lot of people think they can't, and they walk away.
Yeah. And so this is the shift. This is the journey, Austin. I'm curious if you have some wisdom for us about it. Because it seems like often what we try to do, you know, using the metaphor of like container and contents, right? So I'm drinking some coffee this morning, and I've got my little mug, and I've got some coffee in it, right? What we typically do is we focus on the coffee in the mug.
right? And what you're describing is we're recreating the container to hold the coffee,
mm-hmm.
right? So we're changing the frame or the way that we conceive of and hold our faith. That seems to be much more difficult than just giving people some fighter verses to beat back the doubt.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's what the book is about. Like, there are a few specific issues I tackle and mm-hmm. try to offer some helpful content. But on the right. whole, the book itself is kind of an exercise in showing what it looks like to doubt faithfully, which I do think, again, at the end of the day, is more important than having the right answers, because there will always be new doubts for us. I mean, what are our kids going to deal with, right? Like, what's right. going to happen when we discover the aliens or whatever it is? Like,
or the AI singularity.
No end. There's no end to the doubts that will come up. And so if we just give people answers, that's not really going to do much good for long. We got to teach people how to process their doubts. We got to teach people how to think and not what to think would be the obvious kind of thing to mm-hmm. say there.
Yeah.
Yeah. What, I think one aspect of this that's interesting for me, and I think for our listeners as well, is, you know, maybe a lot of us have experienced doubt, like you've been talking about that, and I know I have, and you know, it's been helpful for me to reframe this. So we as leaders experience doubt, and we've got to figure out how to, you know, hold it in a new container and all of that kind of stuff. But do you have any wisdom? Like, you're a pastor, you lead a church in Temple, Texas, and so, like, how do we help others into this kind of new framing when they're experiencing their doubt? How do we create an atmosphere that's hospitable to doubt in our churches, in our ministries, in our daily lives? How can we become people who are receptive to the doubts of others? You know?
Yeah, I think a number of things you could say there, and it obviously depends on your particular context. But in my context, my church is, you know, most folks would still probably identify as evangelical with an asterisk and a lot of footnotes. So, like, our folks, in order to believe that their doubts are something that can actually push them toward God, not away from God, they need to know that it's biblical, and they need to know that there's a kind of a history of it in the church tradition. And so, one of the things that I always do, it's the story I tell in the first chapter of the book, it comes from Matthew 28. It's the Great Commission. The 11 apostles go up on this mountain. They see the resurrected Christ, okay? And we're told that when they saw him, they worshiped him, but they still doubted, right?
Right.
The resurrected Christ. Now, most of us think, man, you know, if I could just see the resurrected Jesus, I really wouldn't need any more proof for the rest of my life. Like, that would be fine. I'd be good. And yet these 11 apostles saw the resurrected Christ, and somehow they still doubted. Mm-hmm. And so if that's possible, right? Well, like, if the apostles could see the resurrected Christ, still doubt, and Jesus could still use them to build the church, then surely Jesus could use us in the midst of our doubts to live out, you know, faithful lives in the midst of a broken world.
Yeah. And in fact, it's not just they worship and doubt, but it's they doubt and are commissioned in the midst of their doubts.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Jesus doesn't say, hey, I'm going to need you to hang up here on the mountain until you got it all figured out. Certainly, then I'll send you out. It's like, no, you're worshiping and you're doubting. That's good enough. I'm going to send you out. You're going
to change the book. Yeah, and then even more amazing to me is that, you know, in Acts 1, we see, you know, this dialogue with the angel. And it's clear that even their content, like, hey, was this? Are you going to make Israel great again?
Yeah,
you know, is this it? And the angel's like, no.
Just to clarify.
Right. But he,
that's,
you know,
not what's happening.
You know, he kind of just
what I want you to do.
He just clap tweets him and tells him to go back to, you know, Jerusalem, right? And so I think we have such a, you know, and you could keep going here with this, right? You could keep going with all the missionaries Jesus sends out in the Gospels, you know. The Samaritan woman and her heterodox theology, the Gadarene demoniac and his no theology. You know, all these missionaries who don't meet sort of the seminary denominational test for what it looks like to be faithful, but who carry faith in their encounter with Christ in the midst of unanswered questions, perhaps, or even, you know, cloudy, how does this all fit together?
Mm. Yeah, well, even, you know, Jesus himself, you know.
Oh, here we go.
In the garden, on the cross.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we can explain it in different ways, but I don't think we can explain away that there seems to be some sort of doubt that Jesus is harboring, which, again, we shouldn't really surprise us. Jesus was fully human.
Right.
And so Jesus knows what it's like to walk around with doubts, and yet Jesus still does the most profound, important act in the history of the world while doubting, in the midst of doubting. So it's absolutely foolish to think we have to choose between faith and doubt, or that faith has to include certainty, when even Jesus, I don't know if we would say Jesus was certain, you know?
Yeah, so part of it is like showing people the biblical record and say, this is our faith. Our faith is like wrestling with God and shouting at God.
Israel.
You know, this is the whole thing. I'm curious as to, I'm thinking of, you know, just churches I've been part of, or, you know, sat in worship services with. And I'm thinking the subtle ways that we can indicate to people. So this is the other side of the question. Like, how do we create an atmosphere that's hospitable to doubt? I think one thing is, like you said, like, let's make sure they understand this is fine. But like, there are subtle ways that we can create an atmosphere that's hostile to people being honest about their doubts, right? I'm thinking of the, you know, just the some of the ways that we can phrase our, you know, sermons, you know, like, or the ways that we talk about the Bible, or the ways that we talk about our faith. That kind of thing. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. Like, what are some ways that we inadvertently create a culture, create an atmosphere where people don't feel safe to own their doubts?
That's a great question. So I think one of the obvious things is, this is a leadership podcast, but it really is something where your people will take a cue from you. And so if your people get a sense that, like, while you talk a little bit about doubt, A, you don't really know what it's like to actually doubt. And that's the way I always felt about most books on apologetics I read, is that they're written by people who don't really know what it's like to doubt.
Yes.
You know, so if your people see that you're not really willing to entertain doubts or be honest about them, then of course they're going to pick up on the fact that they shouldn't be. Because if their leader, their pastor, is not willing to do it, they're not going to. And so I think that's a huge one, is to learn. And again, it's not, you know, spiritual exhibitionism. You don't need to get up there and just vomit every doubt you've ever had. But it is important for you to demonstrate to your people what it looks like to have an honest faith. And an honest faith includes doubts. And so that means things like, you don't tie every single sermon up with a perfect bow. You know, you leave loose ends at places, because life is full of loose ends. And I think when you mirror that and you create space for that, and again, you can build things into your liturgy where you express your doubts as a community, and then you don't immediately follow it up with, but here are the obvious answers to all these doubts, and that's why they shouldn't bother us.
Right.
You got to let people sit with them a little bit. Again, when it becomes normative in worship, that's one obvious way that it becomes more natural in our lives. And then also, obviously, whatever community looks like for you, like, we do small groups, and so it's something we continually teach our small group leaders, that when people are honest enough to really open up about their doubts, don't feel like you have some responsibility to, again, shut it down and explain it away immediately, because, oh my God, what if people in the group walked away thinking there are legitimate reasons to doubt their faith? No, you got to create a space where people can hold their doubts with some tension, find hope for them, sure, but people need to feel like the church is the first place they run to when they have their doubts, not the last place. And unfortunately, that's not the culture we've created a lot of time.
So I'm hearing in that is, like, there's something important about the way that we, if somebody actually confesses a doubt to us, at, like, personally in a conversation, there's something important about the way that we receive it. If we if we jump to, and I'm thinking of, like, early ministry experiences when I would have conversations with people, and they would express some sort of doubt, like, about something, and there would be an anxiety in me that would rise up to basically, like, oh, like, seal this up, like, give them the answer. If you don't know the answer, look it up. You know, make sure that they have an, you know. And I think that the way that people receive that then, right, is like, oh, okay, well, it's not okay to have that doubt. Because there's some answer for it. But, you know, I was always frustrated that the answer never really did the work I was hoping it would do. Like, that's not actually what people need when they're doubting. They don't need the answer. The answer, you know, if there is an explanation or something like that, I think it only becomes helpful after we've learned this new way of holding our doubts. You know, the container.
I think that's very, very well said.
And you have a story in your book about dealing with hell, about this woman who comes to you and says, you know, I think I believe in hell, but I'm really not okay with it. And the entire chapter is basically you having this dialogue with this woman, and she leaves saying the same thing she came saying. But because you were present to her and reflecting back and like basically giving her through the hospitality of receiving and welcoming her doubts without anxiety or fear, right? Or danger, that you kind of situated her question within a larger framework of faith rather than this antagonism of question versus faith. It was question and faith.
Right. And we're doing faith right now as you ask your question.
Right. But I think that's mediated through, not through tutors, but through fathers. Like you said, Austin, we don't need people to tell us what to do with our doubts. We need people who have experienced doubts, who can walk with us through that, and who don't just have theory and abstractions, but have stories and like travelogues.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, it's... Again, when you do a lot of counseling as a pastor, y'all have probably done plenty of counseling. And yeah, you figure out pretty quick that you could solve somebody's problem.
Right.
But there's always going to be another problem, you know. In a marriage, you can give them a couple of helpful pieces of advice. But at the end of the day, what they most need to do is learn how to relate to their spouse in a healthy way. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing when it comes to doubts. Like you said, it's creating a hospitable space where people go, oh, this is what it looks like to process my doubts honestly. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I really can do. You know, when Thomas is frustrated, and, you know, all the other apostles got to see Jesus, and Thomas is like, yeah, you know, don't know about it. Seems too good to be true. What does Jesus do? He says, hey, here are the holes in my hands and my side. Mm-hmm. You know, Jesus meets Thomas where Thomas is.
Yeah.
Even though Thomas gets a bad rap. And I think that's kind of the role that we're called to play, is we meet people where they are. We allow them to put their fingers in the holes, you know, of our explanations and go, they're not perfect, but this is what it looks like to process these things. And most importantly, you're not crazy. Like the saints throughout history have struggled with the faith.
Yeah. You're not defective. There's nothing wrong. There's nothing inherently sort of shamefully wrong with you that you're asking this question. It's really important for people to hear that.
Yeah.
And I would. Well, and for people to know that, like, I think one of the misconceptions about doubt or a crisis of faith is that it's something people went looking for. You know, like they wanted to just do their own thing and went asking too many questions or exploring too many taboos, or they read the Harry Potter books or
listened to secular music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's just not the case, man. Like, for most people, a crisis of faith is the most miserable experience you can imagine.
Yeah.
It really is. It's the most miserable thing you can imagine. And it's not something they went looking for. They didn't want to leave their faith. Their faith wanted to leave them. And that's what it felt like.
Yes. And, you know, one of the main provokers of doubt is where people's understanding of God meets a reality that doesn't comport with it. Right. And so one of the ways that we confront that is just evil, right? It's just evil. Evil in the world. Evil, like,
I'm trying to understand what you're saying.
Theodicy. So people pray for a baby.
Problem evil.
They have a baby. Right. They have a baby, and the baby has a birth defect and dies. Mm-hmm. Right. And so there's ways that we kind of navigate around tragedy that I think eliminate the possibility of us growing through doubt.
Yeah.
So we say, well, you know, God just needed another angel in heaven. That's why. Right. Or if my baby didn't die, then God's glory would somehow be diminished. And so I need this baby's death in order for God to be glorified. Or God has this is all part of God's perfect plan. And you talk about this in your book, Austin. I know you've written other books about, you know, this used to be sort of part of these phrases were part of your repertoire, your theological repertoire.
Yep.
I think part of the work they do is they duct tape the cracks of our theology, like, to keep doubt out. Like, we just can't question any of this happening, because if God is not meticulously ordaining and in control of everything that happens, then it's all a crapshoot, and who knows what's going to happen, and it's all chaos.
Those are the only options we can see.
Right. Right. And so for some of our listeners who maybe, like, most of us grew up with those messages, right? What's an alternative way of handling the things that provoke doubt, in particular, like, the evil that we can't reckon with or explain?
Yeah, so I have a couple chapters on evil in the book, and one of the things I mention is that if evil doesn't cause a crisis of faith, or something close to one for you at some point, then it's probably because you have too little faith and not too much faith. The relentless, pitiless suffering of the world, which all of us know just a little bitty sliver of, you know, because we live in the sheltering constraints of this tiny little space and time. If we were to all be faced with the full suffering of creation, I really do wonder if any of us would still be able to believe. I do. I mean, we know so little of it. And so when that hits and you have a crisis of faith, I like to remind people that that's actually an expression of faith. Because if you didn't have faith in a God of infinite goodness and kindness, then evil wouldn't be a problem for
you.
Right.
You know?
No big deal.
And so there's this direct correlation between how beautiful and kind and compassionate we think Jesus is and how horrific the world's suffering appears to us. And so the more beautiful that we understand Jesus really is and the promises of Christianity really are, the more of a problem evil becomes. And so evil should cause a crisis of faith for you. And if it doesn't, it means you don't understand how beautiful the promises of Christianity are. And so when it comes to how we sort through it, you know, I think the best basic bottom line answer is the classic answer of free will. But even that has enormous holes in it that I can't even begin to answer. And I think it was Moltmann who said at the end of the day, eschatology is really the only credible theodicy, which is just another way to say the only real explanation for suffering or justification of it is the belief that God will make all things right in the end. And that's all we can really say. Like, what else can we say when a baby dies? I don't have any answer for that. The only answer I have is that God will make it right one day. Resurrection is the only answer we have to the problem of evil.
What just to press that a little more, because for some of us, Austin, if I can't trust that God wasn't in control of that baby's death, then I can't trust God. Like, you know what I'm saying? And so how do I then understand a God who is powerful in the midst of evil that seems to happen contrary to who he is?
Yeah, so Roger Olson's one of my mentors, and Roger talks a lot about the distinction in saying that God is in control and saying that God is in charge. And so, and this is, I know y'all, I think, connect with Greg Boyd a lot. This is a similar thing to what Greg would say, is that God's in charge. You know, God's as sovereign as God wants to be. And yet God has chosen to create a world where love is a real possibility. Love requires freedom. Freedom requires the possibility of evil. And so, you know, God has chosen to not be as in control as God could be, because there are other things that God wanted more than being in control, namely love. And so I understand that the struggle going, well, you know what? If God wasn't in control of my child's death, then whatever, I can't find peace. But you just really have to turn that over and see the other side of that coin, which is, do you really want to believe in a God who needs to, you know, ordain the death of children in order to be glorified? I mean, is that really the God of Christian faith, a God who needs evil in order to be glorified? I think on a number of levels, philosophically and theologically, that falls apart pretty quick, because then you end up with a God who needs creation in order to fully actualize God's self or fully display God's glory, because how does God display his wrath or justice if there's not something other than God in the world? You know, is the Father going to be wrathful toward the Son for being perfect? You know, no, God needs to create in order to display God's glory. Which again means God needs something, which is basically denying most all the orthodox tenets about who God is. God is absolutely unnecessary, uncontingent, doesn't need anything to fulfill himself, does not need creation. Creation is an act of grace. And so I think you end up going down, for our friends who love the slippery slope.
Come on, bust it out.
Slippery slope, here we go.
You end up denying the God of Orthodox Christianity if you think God needs suffering and evil to fully glorify himself.
Yeah. This is what part of our project at Gravity, Austin, is we've kind of inherited that God equals power equals control kind of framework. And what we see modeled in Jesus is God equals power equals love. And there's where if you start with control or you start with love, you end up in divergent places about who God is, what freedom means, where evil situates and all that. And I think that our imagination for how to live a spirituality that's centered in love is so anemic. And one of the things I appreciated about your book is that it provokes, it actually does some architecture for us on how to begin to inhabit a different imaginary for what it looks like to live a spirituality that's rooted and grounded in God's love.
Yeah.
So I really appreciated it, man. It's really important to me.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. It's a great book. As we close here, Austin, I want to ask you about a couple phrases that I loved. I love these phrases, and I want you just to explain them real quick, all right?
Yeah.
It's better to be wrong about Jesus than right about something else. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so that's one of the phrases I've been questioned about the most. And so that comes in the context of...
Wait, say it again. Say it again.
Here's the phrase. It's better to be wrong about Jesus than right about something else.
Okay, yeah. So when I was, really in the throes of my doubt and got to this place where I told myself I didn't believe in God anymore, I don't know if I meant it. I don't know if I, honestly, as a Western person, would even know what it means to not believe in God. I almost think the idea of God is too ingrained in the way we've been conditioned to really deny God, but that's another comment for another day. I didn't know if I believed in God anymore. And I knew that certainty wasn't in the cards for me, and none of the arguments, historical, philosophical, experiential, were ever going to be able to tip the scale decisively for me in the place I was at. And so it was like, well, what are you going to do? And came to this place where I realized that even if Christianity proved in the end to be false, I would still rather spend this very brief life that I've been given following Jesus, because I think a life spent following Jesus is the most beautiful way to spend my life, even if Christianity is not the truth. And so in that sense, it's kind of a reverse Pascal's wage. If you're familiar with Pascal's wage, it was kind of this idea that, hey, you know, if Christianity proves to be false and you ended up being a Christian, then there's, you know, you haven't really lost anything. Maybe you would have, I don't know, slept with more people and made more money or something, but whatever, not that big of a deal.
Yeah.
But if Christianity proves to be true and you weren't a Christian, then there might be hell to pay, you know, on the other side.
Yeah.
And so this is just kind of inverting that and saying, even if Christianity proved to be false, you'd still be best served following Jesus with this one brief life you've been given, because it's the most beautiful way to live your life. And so at the end of the day, I'd rather be wrong about Jesus than I would be right about anything else.
I like it. Very good. Here's the other phrase I want you to just comment on briefly. The goal of Christianity is not faith, but love.
Yeah. So Paul there, you know, in 1 Corinthians 13, 13, says, you know, these are kind of the three greatest virtues or acts or postures that as a Christian you want to abide in. Sorry, there's a fly flying in my face. Faith, hope, and love abide these three, but the greatest of these is love, which we've heard that verse a million times. But when you let it settle a little bit, I really do think that most of us think the goal of following Jesus is faith. The thing Jesus wants most from us is faith. And yet Paul has said it real clear. And when Jesus was asked what the greatest commandment was, he didn't say it's to have faith so as to move mountains. He said it's to love the Lord your God with all your heart and love the person in front of you. And so I think it's a subtle little shift there in realizing that the goal of this journey that Jesus has me on is that I would become a person who loves God, loves self, and loves the person in front of me, not that I would become a person of indestructible faith. The reason I think that's important in the context of doubt is one of the worst ways to strengthen your faith is to aim at strengthening your faith. It's kind of like happiness in that sense. Like if you aim at trying to be a happy person, you're not going to be happy. Right. But if you aim at living a beautiful, meaningful life spent in service to others, you're probably going to end up happy.
Yeah.
Right? So in the same way, I think faith is something we find when we come to it indirectly. And so I think the thing that we aim at in our lives is love. And when we love, right, when we pour ourselves out in love, spend our entire lives loving the person in front of us, loving self, loving God, I think we end up with faith and more faith than we would have expected, right? Because love creates faith just as much as faith creates love. And so when you get caught up there and you're, you know, playing that weird psychological game where you're trying to convince yourself you're certain of things that you just can't be certain of, and A, it seems strange that God would ask us to convince ourselves, stop trying to convince yourself, get up off your butt and go love somebody. And you'll usually find that through a lifetime of doing that, you had way more faith than you would have ever expected because love creates faith. And faith at the end of the day is just a posture that makes us more able to receive love. It's not an end in itself.
No. Yeah. Amen.
Beautifully stated.
Strike up the organ.
Yep.
Take up an offering.
Let's take up an offering. I'd love to. Send your checks to
yeah.
Gravity.
Gravity Leadership.
Right, right.
No, we, yeah. We
Vista Community Church.
We do need a benediction, though, to leave this call after that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Let's Matt, I want you to do the benediction.
All right,
okay?
Man.
But I'm gonna tell people you guys can pick up Faith in the Shadows. Anywhere that books are sold. Is it in airports? You got it in airports?
You know, I don't know. If there are any listeners out there who have found it in an airport, right. You know,
yeah.
Shoot me a picture on Instagram.
Yes, very good.
Next time I fly, I'll leave my copy in the seat back.
Yeah.
That's another way
to
do it.
There you go. That'll get it into an airport. Faith in the Shadows, it talks about this posture, but it also does give some really helpful reframings of several things that people do oftentimes have doubts about, like evil, suffering, unanswered prayer, whether or not Genesis and Revelation are literal, science and evolution, hell, etc., etc. You can find Austin online at purpletheology.com. Did I have that right?
Or just AustinFisher.com. They link to the same place.
Mm-hmm. Austin Fisher, or you can find Austin on Twitter at Austin T. Fisher. That's F-I-S-C-H-E-R.
The C silent.
Good German heritage. We kept the C.
Fisher. Mm. All right. That's about it for us.
Thanks for being with us, man. This is great.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure. Let's not wait 33 years next time.
All right.
Sounds good.
We'll run it back. Okay, friends, may you go today knowing that God's love is stronger than your fear, that he is not as scared of your doubt as you are, that he welcomes you in the way you can conceive of him now, and he brings you closer to him as you are honest about where you really are. So go trusting love, not in your own conceptions. Go trusting Jesus, not in all the right answers. And go today to love and serve the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Thanks be to God.
And
thanks be to Austin. Thanks for being with us.
Anytime, guys. Thank you.
All right. Peace.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. If you found it helpful, please let us know by leaving a rating or review on iTunes or wherever you review podcasts. You can also email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com to ask a question, suggest a topic for future episodes. And join our online community for free at gravityleadership.com/join. You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles we found interesting or helpful throughout the week. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join.
At Ritual, Mother's Day is kind of a big deal, and we're celebrating accordingly. Find your ritual. If mom needs a bit of stress relief, digestive support, or is looking to support glowy, smooth skin, do it today with 40% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/podcast. That's ritual.com/podcast for 40% off your first month. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.